Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Tuesday, March 26, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splavik. Here is our first story by Scott.
Thank you, Doug. I'll start with the top story on the front page of the Quad City Times entitled Fiscal Pressure Mounts. Budgeted funds for baseball park have been exhausted. It's written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Having exhausted budgeted funds for contracted improvements to modern Woodman Park, Davenport City Council members are debating how to pay for more upgrade requirements set by Major League Baseball. Davenport City Council members discussed in frank terms Saturday their frustration with a 10-year lease agreement approved in 2021 with Main Street Iowa LLC, the Quad City River Bandits ownership group. The lease covers the use of modern Woodman Park and improvements set by Major League Baseball that the city is required to pay for. Under that agreement, the River Bandits paid about $125,000 less in an annual lease payment in exchange for what city officials said at the time would be more control over future improvements made to the stadium. The 2021 agreement included a list of more than $5 million in planned renovations to modern Woodman Park to bring the 90-year-old stadium, which has been rebuilt and remodeled several times, up to Major League Baseball facility standards. Those improvements include a flood wall extension, a workout room addition, and clubhouse renovations agreed on as top priorities required by Major League Baseball. The city planned to set aside about $500,000 each year for stadium improvements from two different funds, mostly paid for by municipal bonds or local option sales tax revenue. That increased to about $875,000 starting in fiscal year 2024 per the contract. Projects had to be agreed to by both the city and the River Bandits ownership before being done. Then, in the summer of 2023, Major League Baseball officials conducted an audit of modern Woodman Park and laid out more upgrades the stadium would need. Those new upgrades included $365,000 in retrofitted stadium lights, which is underway, a field replacement slash rehabilitation, which could cost between $650,000 and $1 million, and a netting expansion, which city staff said they may rebid because bids came in higher than expected at $78,000 to $133,000. Although those standards were not listed as part of the 2021 contract, city staff told the council on Saturday that their understanding of the city's agreement with Main Street is that it still requires that the city make any improvements Major League Baseball deems are needed to meet its standards. The 2021 contract states that modern Woodman must at all times remain in compliance with all MLB facility standards, and that the city shall be obligated to make all improvements required by MLB under its MLB facility standards. Mayor Mike Mattson said that knowing MLB would come to the city with additional asks outside of the contract, I don't know if we'd have done the contract. The 2021 contract, didn't say we'll do so up to this amount. It said we'll keep it to those standards. At-large Alderman Jasmine Newton pointed out. So again, looking at the face of the contract, it's either you do it or you breach. I'd be interested in hearing from legal if they have a different opinion, but that's the way I'm reading it. The contract passed council 9-1 in 2021, with First Ward Alderman Rick Dunn casting the lone no vote, expressing concern at the time that improvements required by MLB, such as a new HVAC system for stadium suites, focused on a want rather than a need. Dunn reiterated those concerns Saturday, questioning why a field replacement was not on the list of improvement priorities by Major League Baseball in the first contract. The city has already been paying for some of the improvements with planned allocations for future years, staff said. Clay Merritt, the city's director of engineering and capital projects, told the council on Saturday that the city has exhausted its funding in one of the two funding streams. The city agreed to set aside $136,000 per year, raised to $186,000 per year in fiscal 2024, to go toward a stadium improvement fund for the renovations to the stadium. Merritt told the council that past practice was to use future allocations to keep up with improvements to the stadium, leaving no current funding available until 2030. In the second funding stream, the Capital Improvement Fund, the city agreed to set aside $375,000 annually, which increased to an average of $450,000 yearly in 2024. Merritt said the next available funding from the CIF is about $189,000 in fiscal year 2026. So basically what you're saying is we've spent future years' money on projects that have already been completed, Dunn asked, and there's no money left for several years, correct? Merritt said that was correct. Past practice is that this is how we've been able to accommodate some of these projects, is using future allocations, Merritt said. So that would be one of the ones for the council. We can continue that practice even though we're way out already, or do we do something different? In the past decade, between fiscal year 2014 and fiscal year 2024, the city has allocated about $9.8 million for stadium improvement projects at modern Woodman Park, according to a list of projects provided by city staff. We cut the lease payment in half to try to keep baseball here, Dunn said. Now it's getting to be where we can't afford it. Dunn asked the city legal staff what would happen if the city decided not to fund the improvements required by Major League Baseball, and the city legal staff advised that the city council should discuss that in a different meeting format. City staff said there is a particularly high dollar request to build a permanent pedestrian bridge to ensure access during flood event, but they are unsure if it will become a requirement. City staff estimate such a bridge could cost between $3 million and $9 million, depending on how ornamental the bridge is and where and when it's built. At-large alderman Kyle Gripp said minor league baseball is not typically a money-making amenity for cities. He said the advantages of a long-term agreement are that the city can budget smaller amounts yearly rather than investing tens of millions of dollars every 30 years, but that multi-million dollar requests every few years may not be feasible. The pro why you get into a long-term agreement like this is because you maintain an asset over decades as opposed to go into a bond referendum every 20 to 30 years, said Gripp. Of course, this is a subsidy from the city. It always has been, and as long as we've had minor league baseball here. The question is that price getting too high for the taxpayers today, right? And I think that's a very fair question to ask. In February of 2021, the River Bandits finalized an agreement to become an advanced A affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. That came following Major League Baseball reorganizing the minor leagues after the 2020 season. Another nearby Iowa town, Clinton, lost its affiliated team. It is frightening that there are members of the city council who are actively, publicly contemplating breaching our contract and jeopardizing and questioning whether they want to have minor league baseball in the Quad Cities, said Dave Heller, president and CEO of Main Street Baseball. I'm really stunned by that, especially after having just been voted the best minor league ballpark in America. Heller said keeping the ballpark compliant with Major League Baseball standards is the first priority of the contract, because if not, we lose the team. I think if we took away the opportunity for people to see future Major League stars right here in the Quad Cities, that would be a bad thing for the community, Heller said. A 2020 analysis by Visit Quad Cities estimated the River Bandits contribute about $18.7 million in direct spending and economic impact to Davenport annually, based on a full regular season.
Continuing on page one of the Quad City Times, sports betting is booming. New Chicago casino remains on the sidelines. Written by Robert Chanik. Dateline is Chicago. March Madness tipped off this week with a record $2.72 billion expected to be legally wagered on the NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments, according to the American Gaming Association. A lot of that money will be wagered in Illinois, the third largest sports betting market in the U.S. None of that money, however, will run through Bally's Chicago, the city's first casino, which has yet to open its promised sports book. Earlier this month, Bally's Chicago pulled down its sportsbook signage from a designated location on the third floor of the temporary casino at Medina Temple with no timetable for its launch. We will continue to evaluate and plan for a retail sports betting area within the casino, Mark Wong, vice president and general manager of Bally's Chicago, said in a statement. While Bally's Chicago remains on the sidelines, there are a growing number of ways in Illinois and beyond to participate in March Madness action, which has evolved in recent years from office pools to unambiguous online betting. Sports betting is legal in 38 states and Washington, D.C., with basketball-crazy North Carolina going live earlier this month, just in time for March Madness, which tops the Super Bowl for athletic wagering events. It is the largest sports betting moment on the calendar here in the U.S. simply due to the fact that you have 134 games across 18 days, Joe Maloney, AGA Senior Vice President, said. The vast majority of money is bet on the men's tournament, but the women's tournament is drawing increased attention, in large part because of the emergence of collegiate superstar Caitlin Clark of Iowa, who recently broke the 54-year-old NCAA career scoring record of Pete Maravich. The men's 68-team field includes return appearances by Northwestern and Illinois, which should boost local interest. The state now has 13 retail locations to place bets, including the most recent DraftKings Sportsbook at Wrigley Field, which opened March 8. There are also 8 online sportsbooks operating in Illinois, which account for 97% of sports wagering in the state. But 6 months after opening its temporary casino at Medina Temple, Bally's Chicago not only isn't in the game, it hasn't applied for its sports wagering license with the Illinois Gaming Board. The casino plans to repurpose the designated sportsbook space for its highest rolling gamblers. In response to customer feedback, we are converting the once earmarked sports betting area to a VIP services where we can provide enhanced, convenient financial and players club services to our valued VIP customers, Wong said. Bally's launched a retail sports book at its Rock Island Casino in December, but has yet to offer its online Bally Bet sports app in the state. The app is expected to go live in Illinois later this year. Illinois online sports books are all associated with retail locations, casinos, racetracks, and sports venues across the state. The state has twice failed to award an online-only license at a steeper $20 million fee. When Illinois approved sports wagering in 2019 as part of a sweeping gambling expansion bill, customers needed to sign up at a bricks-and-mortar sportsbook to bet online. But that in-person registration requirement was eliminated in 2022, opening the floodgates for the untethered downstate sportsbooks to woo Chicago-area customers. FanDuel, which is associated with the Fairmont Park Horse Racing Track near St. Louis, and DraftKings, which is partnered with the Casino Queen in East St. Louis, are the state's two highest-grossing sports books. Illinois launched sports betting at Rivers Casino in Des Plaines in March of 2020, just days before it was shut down, and the March Madness tournament was canceled by the pandemic. 4 years later, sports betting is booming in Illinois. In 2023, Illinois sportsbooks generated more than $1 billion in adjusted gross revenue. The money kept after winnings are paid out, ranking third behind New York and New Jersey, according to the AGA. Illinois gamblers legally bet $11.6 billion on sporting events last year, according to the Illinois Gaming Board. Nationwide, sports gamblers legally wagered nearly $120 billion last year, according to the AGA. March Madness represents about 2.2% of the total sports betting handle. If projections play out, that would put the over-under on legal March Madness betting in Illinois at about $255 million this year. Even Governor J.B. Pritzker is getting in on the fun, posting his politically correct bracket Thursday on X, formerly Twitter. Now, surprisingly, he is picking Illinois and Northwestern to meet in the Elite Eight and the Fighting Illini to win the men's championship. The women's championship game is scheduled for April 7, while the men's winner will be crowned April 8.
Thank you, Doug. Our next article from the front page is entitled Sorensen Tours the Project. Nonprofit serves the LGBTQ plus community. This article is written by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. Talks about advocacy, funding, and outreach filled the halls of The Project of the Quad Cities on Monday. Congressman Eric Sorensen from Illinois, the first openly LGBTQ plus person elected to federal office for Illinois, visited The Project of the Quad Cities at 4101 John Deere Road in Moline. The nonprofit organization serves the LGBTQ plus community and those living with HIV. The project has been operating in the Quad Cities since 1986 and recently moved into its new, larger building. More space allows for more services and the chance to assist a larger group of people, CEO Caitlin Wells said. She took Sorensen on a tour of the new facility, highlighting Two Rivers Pharmacy, located inside the building, that fills prescriptions for clients on-site in collaboration with case managers. Services for individuals with HIV or AIDS, behavioral health, and LGBTQ plus health care are all provided as well. Sorensen has previously served on the board of directors for the project and is familiar with their mission, he said. Monday's tour, however, allowed for the realization that the need and services have increased significantly. I was able to understand what the needs were in the Quad Cities and see the services that the project gives, he said. Now to see the new space that has doubled or tripled in size, it tells me not just that we live in a caring community, but there is a place here for people before they get to a crisis. Wells said behavioral health is a service that is often in demand, with a wait list to see counselors. Group counseling sessions have been offered instead to help get clients in to see someone right away instead of waiting for availability. In its new space, the project has more rooms for behavioral health and more exam rooms for physical health. Having an advocate in Congress who understands how important their mission is and having him tour, Wells said, is crucial to showing the importance of having the project in the Quad Cities. We're really happy to be able to show him the growth in the new space and continue to talk up the work we do, she said. I think the importance of having him here is also to advocate for both the HIV and LGBTQ community, because that is at the core of who we are. Continued funding for fighting HIV is mission critical, she said, noting society is 40 years past the initial start of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, but the issue remains. Today, it can feel less important because it doesn't feel like as much of a crisis, so I really hope Representative Sorensen is able to take back to Washington that not only do we need level funding to the HIV programs, but increased funding to account for more costs. It's critical to ensure we have no more new infections. Sorensen said the whole goal of the project is to help connect people to healthcare in whatever capacity they need that. During Monday's tour, Sorensen spoke about the importance of securing federal funding and advocating for federal dollars to help continue the mission. Wells said the operating budget for the project went from approximately $3 million 7 years ago to now being approximately $10 million, thanks to the expanded services. Additionally, with Iowa making the decision to ban gender-affirming care for minors, the amount of resources for Iowans have shrunk. Sorensen said despite his position being in Illinois, he sees the need for all people to access the care they need, and the project, he said, is that beacon. Just look at the geography of where we are being here in Moline and understanding it's a short drive to the state of Iowa, where we are seeing these laws at the state level that take away a parent's right, he said. We have to make sure that families have the ability to make decisions, and this is a place where they can do that. Sorensen is up for re-election this year, running as a Democrat. Challenging him is Joe McGraw, a retired judge and former prosecutor who sat on the bench in the 17th Judicial Circuit, which covers Boone and Winnebago counties, according to previous reporting. McGraw defeated Scott Crowell, a farmer from Milan, in the primary last week.
Thank you, Scott. Going to move to the local section here, a couple, three stories. It's kind of short. I'm going to read them and get us up to date. This one is entitled, LeClaire Winery Awarded $25,000. Olathe Creek Vineyard and Winery Awarded the State Grant, written by Gretchen Teske. It says, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship has awarded 26 Choose Iowa value-added grants to Iowa farmers, small businesses, and nonprofits, including one in LeClaire. A news release from Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy's office announced the grants were awarded to facilities in 22 counties, totaling $463,000. Projects the grants are going towards have a total estimated cost of almost $2 million. The Choose Iowa announcement was made as part of Iowa Ag Week during an event at Cortum Farm and Company outside of Indianola, one of the 2024 grant awardees, according to the release. Choose Iowa is the state's signature brand for Iowa-grown, Iowa-raised, and Iowa-made products. These cost-share grants, which match up to $25,000 per project, were created to assist Iowa farmers, businesses, and nonprofits increase or diversify their agricultural product offerings, expand markets, and shorten supply chains. Olathe Creek Vineyard and Winery, 23456 Great River Road in LeClaire, was awarded $25,000 to help increase production capacity and product availability by adding specialized bottling and processing equipment. The entire project is expected to cost nearly $55,000, according to the release. This year's grants will support a wide variety of projects, including delivery and cold storage for direct-to-consumer meat sales. Fruit production and processing, vegetable processing, packaging equipment, cider and wine canning and bottling, farm store and food hub construction, honey production, culinary herb, lavender and cut flower production, warehouse capacity, cover crop seed distribution, and agritourism opportunities. Consumers are continually looking for more Iowa food, beverages, and ag products to enjoy, and these Choose Iowa value-added grants will help Iowa farmers, small businesses, and nonprofits build that supply, said the Secretary of Ag. We are so pleased to provide these Choose Iowa cost-share investments because they will enhance the availability of Iowa products while creating positive economic activity in communities big and small across our state. Individuals, businesses, and nonprofit organizations that live or operate in Iowa were eligible to apply, and preference was given to small to medium-sized entities. This year, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship received 63 eligible grant requests totaling 1.2 $13 million. And since the launch of the grants in 2022, $1,173,690 in Choose Iowa value-added grants have been awarded to 67 projects, which has leveraged a total investment of $4,268,099.19. The full list of awardees can be found on the Secretary's website. I have one short one here. Three high school projects approved, written by Lisa Hammer. It's what we know is the Orion School District took out $5.5 million in bonds to 2 years ago for projects at all three school buildings. What's new? The school board on Wednesday approved $564,900 in improvements to the high school. The projects are new classroom door and frame replacements for $131,000, with the low bidder being Valley Construction. New window replacements for $229,000 from Bruce Builders and High School Commons. Restroom renovation for $204,900 from Valley Construction. A lot of money numbers there. This district will receive $100,000 in two state matching grants. The district has $800,000 left over from its working cash bond 2 years ago. We need to invest it, expend it. You do need to have it as an expenditure, Superintendent Joe Blessman said. These are not frivolous investments. These are things that are years past due, if not decades past due. Many other smaller projects are also on the schedule for this summer. So what's next? Board President Aaron Kayser, K-A-Y-S-E-R, talked about possible topics of future discussion for the board, mentioning weighted grades or a computer concepts class. The board decided to discuss whether to have computer concepts as a mandatory class or not at its April board meeting. Principal Nathan DeBailey, D-E, capital B-A-I-L-L-I-E, will look into the challenges of offering the class, how many sections would need to be offered, and whether it's something that could be offered at the high school level, at grade level. If computer concepts becomes a mandatory class, it would only apply to incoming freshmen to the current seventh grade. And before I turn it over to Scott for the obituaries, quick note on the front page here, there's a Davenport Singer performed at the Iowa women's playoff game. C.J. Parker spent his Saturday night playing a show in Chicago, but just hours earlier, he was high-fiving Caton Clark before the Hawkeyes' first-round March Madness game in Iowa City. Parker, who is a Davenport resident, who has been a Hawkeye fan his whole life, got to sing the national anthem at this weekend's playoff game. It was absurd, he said. This weekend wasn't Parker's first rodeo in singing the anthem, however, at a Hawkeye sporting event. He got his first opportunity at a swim meet in 2023, a gig coordinated by a friend who worked for the university's media department. The performance went well, and Parker was called back to sing before a track meet. As a diehard Hoops fan, he put out some feelers about the chance to sing at a Hawkeye basketball game. He first performed at Carver Hawkeye for the last year's Iowa-Illinois men's basketball game. Then he came back again and again and again. Last year, he sang before Iowa's second-round playoff game against Georgia. This season, he sang the anthem before four women's basketball games, including the Iowa-Indiana game where Caitlin Clark walked off with a buzzer beater. "Now I'm kind of a women's basketball regular," he said. This weekend's game was a different level of surreal, though. Ticket prices for the Hawkeyes' first March Madness game on Saturday surged over $400 on resale websites. Even just being in the building took some luck. But Parker wasn't just in the arena. He was sitting at courtside, singing in the anthem that he's enjoyed his appearances this season. It ends up by saying, "I forgot that I did it," Parker laughed. "I looked on social media, and I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot that I did the anthem in front of thousands of people." So you're listening, folks, to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And it's time to go to obituaries. I'm going to turn it over to Scott.
Thank you, Doug. I'll start with Dr. Robert H. Gunther, G-U-E-N-T-H-E-R. age 94, who passed away peacefully on March 22, 2024 in Davenport. He was born on December 14, 1929. Raised in Davenport, he graduated from Davenport High School and then the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. He served in the Army at Fort Devens, Massachusetts from 1955 to 1957 with the rank of captain. Robert married Barbara Eulinger on June 14, 1952 at St. John's United Methodist Church in Davenport. They had three sons, David, Daniel, and Douglas. Robert practiced dentistry with his father, Dr. Herbert Gunther, at their office building on Washington Street in Davenport, touching the lives of many in the region with their skill in dentures, crowns, and general care. Robert continued the practice after Herbert's retirement. After retiring himself, Robert enjoyed traveling, dancing, creating artwork, and restoring vintage toy cars. Many, including his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, will miss Robert. The family would like to thank friend Rob Dalton for many years of assistance at Warren Street and the staff at the Davenport Lutheran Home for providing care and comfort the last 6 years. He was preceded in death by his father, Herbert, mother, Joanna, and sister, Dorothea Kempf. The Gunther family plot at Memorial Park in Davenport, Iowa, will be his final resting place. In lieu of his service, Robert requested memorials be made to the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. Condolences and messages can be shared online at www.weertsfh.com. Next, Carol L. Brown, age 79, of Davenport, Iowa, went to home to be with her Lord and Savior on Friday, March the 22nd, at Bickford of Davenport. Private family services will be held with burial at Davenport Memorial Park. Cremation will take place at Trimble Crematory in Moline, Illinois, under the direction of Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Memorials may be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. The former Carol Lorraine Fox was born January 5, 1945 in Anamosa with the daughter of Harold and Neva Fox. She earned her degree from State College of Iowa, now the University of Northern Iowa. She married the love of her life, Dennis Brown, on July the 20th of 1968 in Davenport. Carol taught physical education in the Chicago and San Antonio areas until the birth of her daughter in 1972. She later worked at Celebration Bridal Shop in Davenport for 10 years. Carol's grandson, Mitchell, was the light of her life, and she especially loved attending his many school and sporting events over the years. She also enjoyed going for coffee with her friends. Carol is survived by her beloved husband of over 55 years, Dennis, two children, Heather Martins of Bettendorf and Aaron Brown of Davenport, and her grandson, Mitchell Martins. She was preceded in death by her parents and a sister, Edith Edie LeMaster. Carol's family would like to give special thanks to everyone at Bickford of Davenport and St. Croix Hospice for their wonderful care. Condolences may be shared at cremationqc.com. Next, we've got Nancy Ann Boyle, age 69, of Davenport, Iowa, who passed away peacefully surrounded by her family on Saturday, March 23, 2024, at the Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Cremation rites have been accorded with Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island, Illinois. There will be no public service. Memorial donations may be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Nancy's memory. Nancy was born February 26, 1955, to Bernard and Carol Gilman in Moline. She was united in marriage with Robbie Boyle on September 26, 1981. He preceded her in death February 4, 2021. Nancy graduated from Alleman High School in 1973 and Western Illinois University in 1977 with a Bachelor of Science in Law Enforcement Administration. Nancy was a probation officer for the 7th Judicial District of Iowa Department of Corrections in Davenport for 38 years, retiring in 2015. Nancy enjoyed boating on the Mississippi River and playing poker with her girlfriends. Above all, Nancy loved spending time with her family. Online condolences and memories may be shared with Nancy's family on her tribute wall at www.whelanpresley.com. Next, Marcine A. Marcy Wheeler, age 68, of Davenport, Iowa, died unexpectedly on Wednesday, March the 20th, 2024. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, March the 29th, in the Horizon Room at Trimble Funeral Home at Trimble Point, 701 12th Street in Moline, Illinois. Cremation will take place at Trimble Crematory prior to services. Memorials may be made to the family for a fund to be established in Marcy's memory. The former Marcine Eileen in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the former Marcine Eileen Levi was born October the 20th, 1955, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the daughter of Jesse L. and Hattie Penny Levi. She graduated from Bettendorf High School in 1974. She worked over 30 years at Bishop's Buffet before going to work for 10 years and eventually retiring from Silvercrest Assisted Living in Davenport. Family was the most important thing to Marcy, and she especially enjoyed spending time with her daughter and grandchildren. She will always be remembered as a woman with a huge heart that constantly puts others ahead of herself and will be greatly missed by all who knew her. The family invites friends to share stories and condolences at TrimbleFuneralHomes.com. And our final obituary, Shirley M. Ellis, age 87, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away Thursday, March the 21st, 2024, at Hope Creek Nursing, East Moline, Illinois, surrounded by family. A visitation will be held Thursday, March the 28th, 2024, from 9 to 11 a.m. at Second Baptist Church, 919 6th Avenue, Rock Island, Illinois, with the funeral to immediately follow. Per the family's wishes, cremation will follow the service. Born on February the 3rd, 1937, in Rock Island, Illinois, Shirley was the cherished daughter of Edward and Maureen Houston. A trailblazer in her own right, Shirley was the first African-American telephone operator in the Quad Cities, breaking barriers and paving the way. Shirley's love for her family knew no bounds and ultimately led her to depart from the Quad Cities to spend a cherished moments with her grandchildren in Atlanta. She adored fast cars, thrills of travel, new experiences, and places to explore. Her active lifestyle mirrored her vibrant spirit, and she approached each day with enthusiasm and joy. Shirley was a pillar of strength and support, her confidence evident in every stride, with her shoulders back, fashion forward, and always God-fearing. She leaves behind a legacy of love and memories cherished by children Michael, Terrence, and David, grandchildren Christopher, Kayla, Kyle and Cameron Tolliver, Savannah Tolliver, sibling Patricia Bohannon, and sister-in-law Sally Houston. She was preceded in death by her late husband Tommy Lindsay and Eddie Tolliver, her parents Ed and Maureen Houston, and siblings Lyle, Jean, James, and Diana Houston. In this time of grieving, the family finds solace in shared memories of Shirley's life. Condolences and messages of support may be shared with the family at www.whelanpresley.com.
Moving into the opinion section of the paper today, this is from another view, New York Daily News, reads China breaks 50-year deal on freedom. Beijing and its stooges are crushing rights to speak, assemble, worship in Hong Kong. Forget daylight savings time. In Hong Kong, where they haven't used it in a very long while, it's not an hour early, but 23 years in the future, having already reached 2047. That is the year when the 50-year transition from British rule is to end. And during that period, until July 1, 2047, under the terms of the handover of the city from London to Beijing, the laws currently in force in Hong Kong will remain basically unchanged. The agreement between the UK and China also states that during the 50 years, the current social and economic systems in Hong Kong will remain unchanged, and so will the lifestyle, rights, and freedoms, including those of the person, of speech, of the press, of assembly, of association, of travel, of movement, of correspondence, of strike, of choice of occupation, of academic research, and of religious belief will be ensured by law. But that was then. All those pretty words don't mean anything now. The pledge to retain Hong Kong's liberties, including a free press, independent courts, and its own government, didn't even last half of the promised half century. 4 years ago, China's leader, Xi Jinping, and his Communist Party, fed up with protest in Hong Kong, had their phony baloney Standing Committee of the National People's Congress unanimously passed a 1984-ish named Law of the People's Republic of China on safeguarding national security in the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, stripping the city's citizens of their rights. The next year, Beijing changed how elections are conducted in Hong Kong so that only patriots could hold public office. And so, recently, Hong Kong's elected Legislative Council, now stacked exclusively with Beijing stooges, passed a safeguarding national security ordinance on a vote of 89-0. One vacancy is in the council. Having imposed tyranny on Hong Kong wasn't enough for Xi and the Politburo. They wanted their local puppets to do it as well. Do they actually believe that such unanimous staged votes illustrate anything but robotic control? Jimmy Lai, L-A-I, publisher of Hong Kong's Apple Daily newspaper, would be calling all this out. That is, if he wasn't thrown in prison and his newspaper wasn't seized by the government and shut down. The 2021 shuttering of the Apple Daily and its website came a year after Lai was arrested on some bogus charges. His trial began in December and is going on now. We are sure that he'll get a fair trial. On the occasion of the July 1, 1997 handover of Hong Kong to China and the lowering of the Union Jack, the New York Daily News wrote that the barometer of China living up its promise of non-interference for the next 50 years would be Hong Kong's vital and raucous free press, and pressure on the press to conform to the party line will be ominous sign of Beijing's true intentions. The communists aren't even pretending. They are forcing the once free city to become a quiet drone following orders and staying in line. Freedom and liberty will be what the party dictates. Anyone who complains, like Lai, will be dealt with. Someday the Chinese will be free, and someday Hong Kongers will be free again.
In another opinion piece written by Adam Minter, who is a Bloomberg columnist covering the business of sports, and it's entitled March Madness as We Know It Faces Extinction. The NCAA men's basketball tournament, which began last week, won't be the only college basketball competition worth watching this year. 2 weeks ago, organizers of a new tournament planned for the fall at the MGM Arena in Las Vegas indicated they'd offer each participating school up to $2 million in NIL money that must be distributed to current athletes. The Players Era Tournament, as it's known, isn't competing against March Madness, not yet at least, but as college athletics undergoes seismic, money-driven changes, it's one model for the future. Others, intended to further enrich schools, athletic conferences, and media partners, are also emerging. The consequences are stark. By next season, March Madness could look very different. Within a decade, it could be obsolete. Fans now settling into their sofas to watch some great basketball should enjoy this year's tournament as if it's a last dance. The NCAA's first March Madness dance began in 1939. Since then, the organization has steadily grown its men's basketball tournament and the money earned by it. As of 2023, more than 80% of the NCAA's revenues come from the tournament. The NCAA pays out much of the money, roughly $2 million units, to athletic conferences based on each team they qualify and each win they earn. It adds up. The SEC took in $34 million worth of units last year. But the process of getting in is where the problems start, and what has long inspired discussion about alternatives to March Madness. Currently, 32 teams automatically qualify for the tournament by winning their conference tournaments. Most of the automatic qualifiers are from smaller leagues, and competitive teams from bigger conferences often don't make the tournament. For example, the Big East, a longtime basketball power conference, saw three of its 20-win teams fail to qualify for the tournament. In response, the Big East has loudly complained about the NCAA's selection process. And it's not alone. On Wednesday, legendary Michigan State coach Tom Izzo, whose team qualified for this year's tournament, pointedly noted that he wasn't sure the process was good for the game. Potential solutions are on the table. Last year, the NCAA proposed expanding the men's basketball tournament to as many as 90 teams. It didn't specify who would get those slots and how the money would be divided, but change in the tournament's structure is imminent. The Athletic recently reported that the tournament will likely expand to 72 or 76 teams as soon as next year. That's unlikely to be a happy outcome for college basketball traditionalists. Among other problems, it may dilute the quality of play while marginalizing the importance of the regular season. Then there is the question of money. Unless the NCAA's media partners are willing to pay for additional games, conferences would be dividing the revenue pie more finely as the tournament expands. That leaves the biggest conferences with a different and arguably better possibility. Why not start their own postseason competition independent of the NCAA? There's ample precedent that it could work. The college football playoff is owned and operated by 10 athletic conferences plus the University of Notre Dame. CFP, not the NCAA, decides who participates and how the money is divided. It recently completed a new six-year agreement with ESPN that will pay $1.3 billion annually. It's not just the school and conferences that can potentially benefit from this influx of money. NCAA rules do not prevent networks and other CFP sponsors from offering athletes name, image, and likeness payments. A new spring basketball tournament looking for an edge over the NCAA could be the trailblazer. The outcome would be a different kind of event that better reflects the money-driven evolution of college athletics. It may not have the same form as the current March Madness, but the basketball matchups will be superior, and that's the kind of madness every fan should enjoy. And again, that's written by Adam Minter, who is a Bloomberg columnist covering the business of sports.
Thank you, Scott. Going to go to sports page, Quad City Times, page one. And here's an article written by Dave Selvig. It says, Hawkeyes prove they can win ugly. Iowa wins in Clark's home finale. And Dateline is Iowa City. Iowa proved it. Iowa proved it can win ugly Monday night, sending the Hawkeyes to the Sweet 16 for the third time in the last 4 years. Caitlin Clark's final home game resulted in another milestone, but more importantly, Hawkeyes survived and advanced to Albany 64-54. The team stayed on the court several minutes after it was over, soaking in another sellout crowd of more than 14,000 fans who produced ear-splitting noise from start to finish inside Carver Hawkeye Arena. At the end of the game, I would not have left the court if I wasn't forced to get off, Clark said. Clark scored exactly half of the Hawkeye's 64 points, giving her 1,113, a new NCAA single-season record surpassing the old mark of 1,109 by Kelsey Plum in the 2016-17 season. It was not easy for the Hawkeyes in their second-round NCAA tournament game against a scrappy West Virginia squad. Hawkeyes had almost as many turnovers, 15, as made baskets, 17, and finished with just 7 assists, 15 under their average. However, making 25 of 30 free throws, including 14 of 17 in the fourth quarter, was critical. 7 assists is not Iowa basketball, but we only made 17 shots, Clark said. But that happens sometimes. We were gritty and had to really work for it. In her final home game, Clark went out with a bang. The senior from West Des Moines broke a second seemingly unreachable Kelsey Plum record this season. Plum was the all-time NCAA women's scoring leader until Clark opened up a can on that record. Heading into their Sweet 16 game against Colorado on Saturday in Albany, Clark has 3,830 points, 303 more than Plum's 3,527, in 4 fewer games, 139 to 135. The Hawkeyes needed all of them Monday night. We lost in the second round my sophomore year, Clark said. Last year, it was even closer, in the second round. West Virginia is a really good basketball team, she said. Iowa was held to 6 second quarter points, their lowest scoring period of the season, allowing the Mountaineers to hang around. It never got easier from them from there. The Mountaineers, 25-8, were flirting with a massive upset until a critical sequence late in the game. Tied at 52, 5'9" Iowa guard Gabby Marshall blocked a three-point attempt from West Virginia star J.J. Quinterly. The ball fell to Sydney Affolter, who drove the length of the court. Affolter converted a tough left-handed finish in the lane and was fouled. The sophomore from Chicago made the free throw, and the Hawkeyes closed it out at the line. Affolter finished with 13 points. Hannah Stolke posted a double-double with 12 points and 11 rebounds as the Hawkeyes won their second lowest point total of the season and were held under 70 for just the third time all year. It wasn't the prettiest game by any means, Clark said. It was not. But that does not matter. The Hawkeyes are headed for New York.
On page B3, Illini seek more after snapping drought. Illinois to face Iowa State in first trip to Sweet 16 since 2005. This is written by Anderson Kimball. It was a big occasion, so Illinois coach Brad Underwood and his staff had devised a plan. After big wins, Underwood's players douse him with water, and since this was arguably the biggest win of Underwood's tenure, he wanted to turn the tables. Underwood and his assistants were armed with water guns as they ran into the locker room to soak his players in celebration. Players and coaches sprayed each other. Luke Good used his water bottles as a squirt gun to return fire after a manager clued the players in on what was going to happen. It was release for the coaching staff and for a program that's heard all year that Illinois hasn't made it to the Sweet 16 since 2005. It was a fun time. Water was going everywhere, Marcus Damask said. I think in college basketball, you've got to celebrate wins. Wins are hard to come by, and a Sweet 16 is hard to come by. We want to celebrate it, but then, at the same time, we've got our mindset on the next game, too. Damask has gotten to savor a deep run in his first ever tournament, but Underwood and some of Damask's teammates have been well acquainted with the difficulties of March. Underwood was able to make his first second weekend in his fourth try as head coach, three of those with the Illini, being a top four seed. As a team that's racked up conference titles, three in the past four seasons, as well as being the Big Ten's winningest program in the past four seasons, NCAA tournament success was the only thing missing from its mantle in the Underwood era. I think for the program's sake, it's mind-blowing to me, and I think there is frustration that we had one seed and got upset this very game. But this program is elite, and to not be there in 18 or 19 years, to me, that's more mind-numbing, Underwood said. We had tough draws and a couple of injuries, and you get beat. That's the beauty of March Madness. It feels good to be advancing with this group. I've said all along this is one of my favorite teams to coach, if not the favorite. So yeah, on to Boston. Those heartbreaks, including a loss to number 8 seed Loyola Chicago as a top seed in 2021, or a collapse against Houston in 2022 before the Illini were bounced in the first round by Arkansas last season, left a sour taste in the mouths of those who remembered those moments. Illinois had two consensus All-Americans in Kofi Cockburn and Ayo Dosunmu, while also featuring key role players like Trent Frazier and Damonte Williams. I'll never forget the pain, like the heartbreak of not being able to play with those guys again, Illinois Luke Good said, especially freshman year, you know. Kofi and Trent and all those guys that meant so much to the program that unfortunately weren't able to make it out of the first weekend. Illini past and present got to revel in the March success the program earned on Saturday night. Frazier, who plays professionally in Russia, followed the game and got to see the program he led and helped flip make another first. I hope they're smiling, Underwood said. I hope they're happy and proud. They built this thing. It's for those guys. I'm disappointed that we never got to move on. They deserved it. They were all Americans. There's been a lot of guys that didn't receive all those accolades but were part of great teams. I hope they're all happy. I hope they're all happy today, got a smile on their face, and are enjoying the moment. The moment was one Illinois relished, but in a fast-moving single-elimination tournament, it's also one it'll move past quickly. Underwood and players were already looking forward to a Sweet 16 matchup with Iowa State on Thursday, a little over an hour after the final buzzer. We're not done yet, Underwood said.
That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today.